Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz invokes race and politics in his criticism of special counsel Robert Mueller and the grand jury he impaneled in Washington.
That's a completely Democratic district, as distinguished from Virginia, which is a swing state, and it has an ethnic and racial composition that would be somewhat less favorable to Donald Trump.
Also today, Brigham and Women's Hospital has dropped out of the top 20 on the U.S. News and World Report rankings. But how much should you trust those ranking sites anyway?
Unfortunately, none of these websites have the complete picture. A lot of them have data that is pulled out of billing data that was constructed for an entirely different reason than ranking quality.
And a former Google engineer says there may be a gender gap in tech because of biological reasons and that Google lacks political diversity. He got fired. We'll get reaction next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to begin today with celebrated Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz. He made headlines on Friday in an interview with WABC Radio when he said that a new Washington, D.C.-based grand jury impaneled by special counsel Robert Mueller could give prosecutors a, quote, tremendous tactical advantage if they want to bring a case against anybody in the Trump administration.
The case now can be brought not in Northern Virginia, which is a swing area, sometimes Democrat, sometimes Republican, but the District of Columbia, which is always solidly Democratic and has an ethnic and racial composition that might be very unfavorable to the Trump administration.
And yesterday, Dershowitz furthered his thinking in an opinion piece for The Hill, where he wrote, quote, prosecutors who have wide discretion in choosing where a case will be tried often consider the racial composition of the jury pool along with other factors in deciding the venue of a trial. That is simply a fact of life that few will dispute. Well, many people are disputing with Professor Dershowitz, and he joins us now on the line. Professor Dershowitz, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you so much. People are arguing with me, but I haven't heard a single experienced, honest lawyer actually get on the radio and television and say, you know, Dershowitz is wrong. It doesn't give any kind of tactical advantage to the prosecutor to have the trial in the District of Columbia rather than in Virginia. Every experienced lawyer knows that that's true. Every experienced lawyer knows that prosecutors and defense attorneys venue shop. They try very hard to get their cases in places where they think they will have an advantage. Nothing wrong with it. I'm not saying that that jurors in the District of Columbia are less fair than jurors in Virginia. I'm just saying that life experiences, political affiliation, ethnicity, race, wealth, poverty, all of these things, educational level, all impact on jury selection. And every lawyer knows that. The Supreme Court knows that. That's
Professor Dershowitz, if I may, you've said a lot there, and I want to dig into it in detail, if I could. First of all, let's just get to the race part here,
sure.
Okay? Because I just for clarity, and I think you said it, but just for clarity, I mean, are you saying at all that you think that African Americans cannot faithfully and impartially do their jobs on a Mueller grand jury or any subsequent trial jury that might involve members of the Trump campaign?
Of course not. Of course not. African Americans are as fair as any other group, but they bring their life experiences to bear, just as whites.
But this is an investigation about Russia, about possible collusion, about maybe even espionage. I mean, if we were talking about a police shooting, it might matter.
A bridge to sell you in Brooklyn, if you believe that. This is an investigation of Donald Trump, one of the most unpopular people in the District of Columbia. Yes, it involves Russia, and yes, it involves other things, but when you have a trial, you're talking about the person who's on trial. Look, I've had prosecutors look me in the eye and tell me, your client can't plead not guilty in this case. Look at the ethnicity of the jury. He's going to walk in there. They're going to all think he's guilty. Prosecutors use that as a tactic all the time in eliciting plea bargains. Every lawyer in a civil suit picks the venue based on these facts. It doesn't matter whether the trial's involving Russia or whether it involves something else.
Well, I want to get to the venue picking in detail in a second, but I can't quite let the issue of race go, because as you know, it's one of the things
it's the third rail.
But I want to see how far does your logic extend? Because as you recall, during the campaign, then candidate Trump very openly and aggressively criticized federal judge Gonzalo Curiel for his Mexican heritage, saying that he couldn't be an impartial judge because of his heritage in the Trump University case. He called that common sense.
It's not common sense. He was wrong about that.
So then how does it differ with a jury?
Because I didn't say that anybody would be unfair. I would just said that people bring their life experiences to bear.
Well, that's exactly what Donald Trump said as candidate about Judge Curiel.
He's wrong. There's no experiences. The guy was born in Indiana. Let me give you an example. When the prosecutor in the O.J. Simpson case, which I was involved, decided to bring the case in central Los Angeles rather than in Brentwood, he did it because he understood the difference in the racial composition in the two areas. When Marsha Clark picked a jury that had 9 black women, she did it because she understood that it would, in her view, give her certain advantages. The Supreme Court recognized that in the Batson and other cases, and that's why they said you have to make sure that juries are diverse, representing people of different life experiences. It's not that juries will be unfair or that they will be consciously discriminatory. It's that juries are not computers. They analyze the evidence based on their life experience. You talked about a police shooting. One of the reasons we, the O.J. Simpson defense team, wanted a predominantly black jury is because we understood that black jurors in Los Angeles probably have more experience with police abuse personally and through relatives and would be more open to accepting an argument that the police may have tampered with the evidence.
But what experience in a possible members of a possible jury pool from Washington, D.C., who are African-American, would pertain to allegations and possible, I mean, we're not even there yet, but possible indictments regarding Russia and the Trump campaign?
It has nothing to do with what the allegations are. It has everything to do with who the defendants are. It's the defendant who's on trial, and jurors look at the defendant.
But then how could a Republican-based jury pool be any more objective?
I'm not suggesting they would be more objective.
Fair or impartial.
I'm not making any point about fair or impartial. All these juries could be fair and impartial in their own mind. They are. Certain jurors, certain juries, certain venues give advantages to one side rather than the other. Every lawyer in the world who's honest knows that. That's why, by the way, many people oppose the jury system and would prefer to go to the European system where you have trained professional judges. But we opted for a jury system. We opted for a jury system which is hopefully diverse, representing a wide range of views that and a wide range of life experiences that jurors can bring to bear. This is an observation that is utterly uncontroversial. And if Donald Trump were not involved in this, nobody would have even mentioned it or picked it up. Everybody would have said, ho-hum. Of course that's true. Read the Batson case. Read NAACP briefs. Read what Johnny Cochran argued. Maxine Waters, who called me a racist, proposed Johnny Cochran for a Medal of Honor, basically, after he died. And it was Johnny Cochran who probably taught me more than any other of my mentors about how salient race and ethnicity and educational levels are in jury selection. Every honest lawyer will tell you that, but they might not tell it to you on the air. That's the difference. I say publicly what other lawyers whisper privately.
But you're
waiting for a lawyer to come on the air and say that what I said is not accurate. They may say I shouldn't have said it, but I challenge you to get a lawyer to come on the air and to say the following words. I do not believe that the prosecutor has obtained any advantage in jury selection of a petty jury involving associates of Donald Trump by having the case in the District of Columbia rather than in Virginia.
Okay,
you're not going to get anybody to say
so
that.
So you are implying political intent, though. You're implying...
I am not. I'm talking about effect. I'm talking
but,
about the
effect. But I want to explore whether or not Robert Mueller even had a choice in regarding impaneling this D.C. Well, hang on here for just a second, Professor, if you could, because,
sure.
I mean, we've done a lot of research, we've talked to a bunch of folks today, and what I'm hearing from several people is that he may not have had a choice, that the grand jury that was impaneled in Alexandria in Virginia may have been a regular grand jury with a fixed period of time. He may have been running out of time with that grand jury.
Whoever tell you that doesn't know what they're talking about.
Well, it was a former U.S. attorney. I mean, it does matter.
The
And then the U.S. attorney's manual itself.
Yeah.
I have the section here.
Let's stop with that.
But wait, if I may finish. Finish here. The U.S. attorney's manual itself says a case should not be presented to a grand jury in a district unless the venue for the offense lies in that district, implying that Robert Mueller's investigation may now include offenses potentially or allegedly occurring in the District of Columbia, and therefore he has to impanel the grand jury there.
Wrong. Let's start with the first one. Running out of time. Very simple. You file a one-page statement, ex parte, to the judge seeking an extension of the grand jury. Always granted, never denied. That's number one. Number two, you want to impanel a second grand jury? You impanel a second grand jury. Grand juries don't matter. A grand jury will indict a ham sandwich if the prosecutor wants them to. A grand jury consists of 23 puppets sitting on 23 pieces of furniture that are moved around by the grand puppeteer called the prosecutor. So it's not the grand jury that matters, it's the petty jury. So now let's turn to your venue. Venue could lie in almost anywhere in the United States because the investigation involves whether or not Russia influenced the election. By the way, the only place there's difficulty is the District of Columbia because they don't really vote for a president. But it could have been in New York, it could have been in New Jersey, it could have been in Pennsylvania, it could have been in Virginia. It could have stayed in Virginia because once you have venue over the core elements, then you can have the grand jury investigate other issues as well. Venue is very, very easy to establish in a federal case. So, you know, you're not getting really the right correct responses. If this didn't involve Donald Trump, the same former U.S. attorneys would be giving you different answers. They'd be giving you answers. You know, for me, the test is always the shoe on the other foot. People say, I'm standing up for Donald Trump. I would be doing exactly the same thing if Hillary Clinton had been indicted. If she had been elected president, the Republicans who control Congress and the Senate would be saying, lock her up.
Sure, and Professor, honestly, I would have been asking you the same questions.
I would have. Let's get off your personality for one second, and let's get to general people. So I would have been talking very hard about how we're expanding the criminal law and how we shouldn't be going after Hillary Clinton, and all the people who today hate me would love me, and all the people who today love me would hate me, because when it comes to partisan politics, everyone's a hypocrite, and all they care about is whether it hurts or helps them. It's like my grandmother. My grandmother, when I used to come home from a Brooklyn Dodger game, and all excited, I'd say, Grandmother, Brooklyn Dodgers won. And she'd say, yeah, but was it good or bad for the Jews? So today, it's the same thing. Is it good or bad for the Democrats? Is it good or bad for the Republicans? Is it good or bad for Jews? Is it good or bad for blacks? Is it good or bad for women? Is it good or bad for men? Is it good or bad for gays? That's the way people think about issues today. There is very little discussion of enduring principles.
Professor, if I may jump in, this is exactly a point where I do want to ask you another question.
Sure.
I mean, we could have differing opinions on all the reasons of impaneling a grand jury in D.C. But there's a deeper issue that I do want to ask you about,
sure.
And you're pointing to it right now, and that these are not normal times.
Every time is not normal time.
But if I could just finish, because
I
just would like to ask you a question here. We have now come through, and we are still in a period where the the current president of the United States. And yes, it does matter that it's Donald Trump because he spent much of his campaign maligning the justice system. Mm-hmm. He has brought with him a special chief advisor in Steve Bannon, who has explicitly said part of his mission is to, you know, deconstruct the administrative state, to undermine what right. I consider fundamental aspects of our democratic system.
And that's why I voted against him, and that's why I'm
But my
vote
my point is that now here we have in you one of the most prominent legal scholars in the country bringing, assigning or impugning the special counsel and saying mm-hmm. that there's politics going on here. And in a sense, you are giving cover to theories that are now being peddled by Sean Hannity and Newt Gingrich, who also seek to politicize the justice system. I mean, can you understand why people are concerned and outraged about this? Are you not concerned about the strength and fundamental integrity of the justice system right now?
I am a man of principle. I will stick by my principles. I will tell the truth no matter where the chips fall. I can't stand Sean Hannity. I refuse to be on his show. He has personally insulted me and attacked me. He has made anti-Semitic comments about me. I can't stand the guy. The fact that he quotes me, I can't help that. The fact that Newt Gingrich quotes me, I can't help that. I have made the same positions, stood by the same positions for 30 years. I stood for it when Tom DeLay was falsely accused. I stood for it when Senator Stevens was falsely accused. I have made a career out of arguing that we shouldn't be criminalizing political differences. I've made a career out of arguing that the grand jury is an abusive institution. I have made a career out of arguing that we shouldn't stretch and expand the criminal law. I'm not going to change it because you think these are abnormal times. When Thomas Jefferson told the Justice Department that they had to prosecute Aaron Burr and that he was going to have the Chief Justice impeached unless he found Aaron Burr guilty, those were special times too. When the Kennedy administration went after their political enemies like Roy Cohn, those were special times too. Every time seems special, and that's when civil liberty suffers, when we think special times justify the diminution of civil liberties. And I'm not going to accept that. I may be overruled. I may be outvoted. I'm making a lot of political enemies. Look, I'm spending the summer in Martha's Vineyard. I'm not getting invited to dinner parties because people think somehow I'm on Trump's side. I am not on Trump's side. I am on the side of civil liberties. And for me, it's always the shoe and the other foot test. I made right. that same test when Bush versus Gore, and I went after the Supreme Court with a vengeance. I accused five justices of the Supreme Court of violating their oath of office. Liberals loved me when I did that. But now when I criticize the judicial system or the independent counsel system, suddenly the same liberals who loved me during Bush versus Gore hate me now. Well, that's the cost of being a principled person. I'm going to stick to my principle.
No one should ever apologize for sticking to
I'm
their principle.
You also happen
to be speaking with someone who feels very fiercely about her own principles. And one of them is it's hard for me to back down from a challenge. So I have a question for you. Earlier in this conversation, you issued a challenge. You said, can we find a lawyer to disagree with you?
To state that he doesn't think that the prosecutor has obtained a tactical advantage in getting a petty jury in the District of Columbia instead of in Virginia. That's
okay.
what I'm looking for.
Well, with your permission, I actually we have someone on the line.
Good.
I don't want you to feel like we're sandbagging you here,
no,
so I'm just
right
just letting you know. So I would like to bring into the conversation. We didn't plan this, but like I said, I don't back down from a challenge.
Tell me who it is.
It's Judge Nancy Gertner, retired.
Nancy is my close friend, my buddy.
She also happens to have a very different opinion. Very different opinion here.
Disagree with.
Oh, hang on here. Let me just introduce her to the listeners.
Saying it, she knows you get tactical advantages.
Well, let me just bring her in here.
Nancy
Gertner is a retired federal judge from Massachusetts. She's also WBR's legal analyst and I guess my co-pugilist in this conversation.
Sure.
Judge Gertner.
All right, Nancy, say the following words. I do not believe that the prosecutor will get any tactical advantage by having a
well, maybe you should let her say her words.
No, I'm putting my words.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a different position. In the articles that you wrote, and you said that Mueller brought a grand jury in Washington in order to obtain a tactical advantage.
We're not talking
that's
about that. People could disagree with
no,
that.
No, no, no. That's what you.
I want you to disagree with my observation.
Let me finish.
Yeah.
That's what you said. You said it was in order to obtain. That, as someone who has presided over grand juries, as someone who defended people who have been indicted, and now as someone who writes about grand juries, that's simply wrong. Mueller moved, had a grand jury in D.C. because he's investigating White House crimes. And just like Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and Richard Nixon was investigated in the venue where those crimes took place, so will Trump be investigated. The Eastern District of Virginia is a narrowly focused investigation. In fact, it pertains to the time after Flynn left the administration, left the Obama administration, and before he entered the Trump administration.
Yeah.
And it is focused on Virginia venued crimes.
So you prove my, you just proved my point.
Wait. In addition, it is not at all clear to me that one can extend the grand jury in Virginia, because both because of venue and because it's a regular grand jury that can only sit for 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
There's every reason to believe that Mueller wants time and needs a different setting. The only venue
issues.
Here that makes sense would have been Washington, D.C., possibly New York. And it could not have been anywhere in the country. And had he chosen anywhere in the country, that's the moment that we would have said, aha, it is tactical. But Washington, where Clinton and Andrew Johnson and Trump is now being investigated, is par for the course.
So we have two issues. And on one, you're refusing to disagree with me because you know I'm right. And on the other, you're disagreeing, and that's reasonable. The two issues are this. Let me finish.
Here.
The two issues are very, very distinct. One is an empirical issue, a factual issue, and that is, has Mueller obtained a tactical advantage?
That's not the position.
That's what I said.
What you have said in your Hill article and what you said on the radio was that he did this for the purpose of securing a tactical advantage.
There are two points. You can disagree with both. You can disagree with one. There are two points. One is an empirical effect point, and I've made it very clear. The effect is to give Mueller a tactical advantage. Nancy, I challenge you to disagree with that. And then we'll talk about
that. And you know why I disagree?
I challenge you to disagree with
that. Well, you've issued the challenge, Professor. Let the judge respond.
I do disagree for this in this respect. The notion that African Americans would stand differently with respect to allegations of espionage is troubling. If this were a police abuse case, it would have been one thing. But the notion that there's any meaningful difference as between the races with regard to a foreign power's intervention in the American election is really extraordinary.
But you and I, Nancy, have talked about cases over and over again where you have a person, whether it's a Hasidic Jew with a long beard, whether it's a black person, you get a black person in front of an all-white jury in Mississippi, it doesn't matter what the crime is. There's going to be a different view there. And so,
the fallacy of what you're saying is the Eastern District of Virginia voted for Hillary Clinton in substantial numbers. The choice to move this case to Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
was where venue, records, and presidents get investigated.
We're still that you're talking about the second point. You're talking about the second point now. I want to distinguish the two points. The main point I made, and the reason why Maxine Waters called me a racist, Dahlia Lithwick called me a racist, and Richard Painter called me a racist, was not the point on which we may have some disagreement, and that is Mueller's motive. What we're talking about is the effect. And Nancy, I don't think, honestly, you can look in your heart and deny, even though you're right, Northern Virginia went for the Democrats this time. It's a split. It's always a swing area. You cannot deny that.
Yes, but I think there is some tactical
advantage in having a case which is in an area which is 95% Democrat when you're putting the president's associates on trial. You just cannot persuade me or yourself that that isn't at least a potentially correct view. So once
you
we
know
agree
the
with
other
that,
the other side of the coin here, by the way, yeah. is that the special counsel is subject to regulations of the Department of Justice.
Right.
It's entirely possible that the decision to impanel a Washington grand jury would have been approved at the highest levels of the DOJ.
You're talking about the second
point, Nancy. Wait, it's entirely possible that it wouldn't have even crossed anyone's mind to even get an approval precisely because this was such an ordinary
Nancy, you're talking about the second point now. The second point
Professor Dershowitz and Judge Gertner, if I may jump in here, this has actually been a truly riveting conversation, and I was sitting back and being an intent listener here, but I'm also looking at the clock and reminding myself that I have the rest of my program to attend to.
Our lives argue about this because we argue about so many things over time.
But
it's so interesting because Nancy is usually to the left of me and more tougher on prosecutors, and I'm usually more to the center. But when it comes to Trump, everything
yeah.
changes.
No,
well,
what I would like to say to both of you is
to express my extreme gratitude that we had this conversation. because honestly, I mean, yes, Professor Dershowitz, there have been extraordinary times in American history, but this is the one we're living in. So I am grateful.
Can I ask Nancy one question?
Only if it's very quick.
Very Nancy, do you think I'm a racist?
I refuse to answer on the grounds it may tend to incriminate me.
I don't like that answer. You know me well enough to know that I was not motivated in any way by any thoughts of racism, any more than anyone would be in picking juries and
no,
trying
but,
to
I mean,
get
but,
more
but
blacks
I think,
on a jury.
The
you always
here.
Want as
I'm going to ask, I'm going to play my part as judge in this conversation
okay.
to ask that this conversation be taken to a sidebar because I've got to go to a break. Professor Alan Dershowitz, thank you so very much for joining us. And Judge Nancy Gertner, WBUR's legal analyst, thank you both as well. Listeners, I think you probably got as worked up as I did. Let us know how you think. Send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Well, welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The U.S. News & World Report's annual hospital rankings came out today, and only one Massachusetts hospital made the honor roll list of top 20. That's Massachusetts General Hospital. They made it at number 4. That means for the first time in 24 years, Brigham and Women's Hospital isn't included on that list. A spokesperson for the hospital says while they're disappointed not to be included, quote, "we are confident that high-quality care we provide to our patients has not wavered." They also cite some changes in the rankings methodology. But the U.S. News & World Report is just one group among many that evaluate hospitals, including the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Consumer Reports, and even Yelp. And it can all be very confusing. I mean, if you're number 3 on one list and number 10 on another and not even on yet a third list, what does that actually mean for the quality of care that the hospital is providing? And if you're a patient, say you break an arm, how much should you really take these rankings into consideration when you need care? Well, joining us to explain is Dr. Ashish Jha. He's a professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health and director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. Dr. Jha, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. First of all, I mean, were you surprised by the Brigham not being in the top 20 of the U.S. News rankings?
You know, I was a little bit. They've made it to the top 20 pretty consistently year after year. Every year, U.S. News changes its methodology a little. I was surprised it made enough of a difference that they dropped out.
Okay. So let me just jump to the second question here. I mean, does it even matter?
Well, you know, it matters in the following way. First of all, you could ask, does it matter which hospital you go to? And I think the answer to that is overwhelmingly yes. Hospitals vary a lot in performance. Some of them are really terrific. Other ones are less so. I guess the second question is, how much do these rankings capture that? And there, I would say some rankings are really not very useful at all, and other rankings are much better. And U.S. News tends to be one of the better ones. It tends to use pretty good data and overall overall, I think it's a pretty useful measure.
Interesting, because it's quite different when it comes to its other famous college rankings, for example. People have a wide variety of opinion on whether or not those college rankings are very useful. But it sounds like you feel differently about their hospital ranking. So, I mean, should people be looking at lists like this when deciding where to get their care? Because in a certain degree, we don't actually... We have choice, but maybe not that much choice.
Yeah. So look, I think if you ask yourself, what do you care about when you go to the hospital? For most people, the number one thing is like having a good outcome, right? If you're really sick, you don't want to die. You want to be treated with dignity and respect. You can go track that kind of data down for hospitals. That's out there. It's available. U.S. News, one of the reasons I like it is because a big chunk, in my opinion, not enough of a chunk, but a big chunk of the rating is driven by those outcomes. Data. And so it's a pretty reasonable shorthand. If you have more time and want to do the digging yourself, you can get better data out there on the web. But I think as a shorthand, it's not a bad place to start.
Okay. Well, what about this slightly different view? It's from Mary Beth Shannon, director of the California Healthcare Foundation's Informing Decision Makers program.
Yep.
And she says that hospitals aren't consistently good or consistently bad on all the different services they provide because they are such complex places. And maybe that makes it difficult to take stock in these rankings.
Yeah, no, so she's got a good point, right, which is that no hospital is perfect or terrific at everything or awful at everything. But what we know from really now 15 years of data from really good studies is that things like leadership, management, practices, those really do vary from hospital to hospital, and they actually have effects across all your care. So it might be that you're terrific at cardiology, but if you have great leadership and really good management and really good health information system, that's going to show up in better quality in your OB care, in your heart disease care, in your diabetes care. So I actually do think there are some of these broader themes that cut across the entire institution.
Hmm. Now, what about in terms of, in reality, how much choice patients actually have? Because aren't they largely constrained by, you know, what their insurance will cover?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And so if you have Medicare, for instance, and you generally have more flexibility, Medicaid patients often have more flexibility. If you're a privately insured patient, the way I am, or a lot of people are in kind of managed care programs, you are much more limited by what's covered in your network and what's not. And so therefore, people tend to have, you know, fewer choices. Most people still have some choices, and paying attention to where you're going still matters.
Mm. And do we know if insurers look at these rankings at all, or are they, it's completely, they ignore them because they're negotiating with hospitals, for example,
yeah,
directly.
It's a funny thing, because insurers basically try to ignore them, but hospitals market the heck out of them,
right,
and make it very hard for insurers to ignore them. So if you're ranked really well on U.S. News, you're going to market that to the community. The community is going to say, oh, I really want to go to that hospital. And then the hospitals use that as a way to negotiate higher prices with insurers.
Hmm. I wonder, though, are there better ways to make these decisions than the rankings? I mean, the rankings are convenient, right?
Yep.
You just sort of go to one place, you see the list, you also can sort to figure out the basis by which they've done these rankings. But is it the best way to make a decision? Are there other resources that patients could go to if they have choices in terms of where they get their care?
Yeah, so as I said, you know, I think U.S. News is better than other rankings. It's still, I think, that, for instance, a chunk of it is still based on reputation. A chunk of it is still based on all these other factors that I think are not so important. So look, if you really want to do this for yourself and you have the time and ability to do this, I mean, obviously beginning by talking to your doctor and getting your doctor's experience is important. But you can go to the Hospital Compare website that's run by the federal government, and there's some really good outcomes data on there, and you can go through that and try to do the work yourself of just really focusing on outcomes, because you don't want to be distracted by a lot of other features. What you really care about, I think, most of the time, is are you going to have a good outcome if you get sick? And U.S. News is an okay way to get that. There are even better ones.
Okay. So are there measures that you would like to see the ranking systems use that currently aren't?
Yes, I think we've made progress on this, by the way. You know, 10 years ago, I think these rankings were all reputation. And, of course, reputation is circular because you get ranked really high, and then next year everybody's going to rank you high because the reputation is good. So I think we've moved forward on looking at things like mortality, looking at things like infections, looking at how often people say they're treated with dignity and respect. I think we're making progress. I want to see much more of that. I want to see, if you have hip surgery, what you really care about is, in 6 months, will I be up and walking around around and being able to run if I did that before. That kind of stuff, that stuff the patients really care about, we're still not really measuring it, and it's mostly, to the extent that we are, it's not making it into the rankings yet. I want to see that stuff show up.
Yeah, and I wonder, and forgive me if this is a slight repetition of an earlier question, but is there also, could these rankings imply a superiority of care that doesn't necessarily exist? Because I'm thinking in practical terms, especially in a place like Greater Boston, where there is such a surfeit of great hospitals, that, you know, if you don't see a hospital in the top 10 or top 20, it may be very human to think, oh, maybe the care isn't so great there, when in truth, the differences might be very slight.
Yeah, so no, that's a great point. Look, there are 5,000 hospitals in America. There are about 60 hospitals in Massachusetts. I think there are differences between hospitals. Which hospital you go to really does make a difference. But, you know, the rankings, if somebody's ranked third versus ranked 10th, does that matter? Probably not. And if we did a ranking of all the hospitals in Massachusetts, is number one going to be different than number 50? Absolutely. But I wouldn't worry too much. It's kind of like the college rankings where one year one university is number two, the other one is number three. No one should be choosing based on those small differences. To the extent that you can really look at the broad trends over time, you get a sense that there are some really top-performing hospitals. For instance, Beth Israel Deaconess, I think, is one of the best hospitals in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even show up in the rankings.
Right.
But it's actually a terrific place. So there are lots of institutions that do really well.
Well, that's Dr. Ashish Jha. He's professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health and director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. Dr. Jha, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Women like people, men like things. Women look for work-life balance, men seek status. Women are prone to anxiety, and therefore, Google shouldn't do, quote, arbitrary social engineering of tech just to make it appealing to equal portions of both men and women. Well, that, in a nutshell, is part of an internal memo written by James Damore, a senior engineer at Google. He said that the company goes too far in its attempts to diversify its workforce. He also wrote that Google's company culture has left it blind to its own biases and was alienating conservatives. Because of all possible forms of diversity, Damore says Google most strikingly lacks viewpoint diversity. Well, in response, Google fired Damore, saying he had violated the company's code of conduct. But Damore's defenders are saying that it's Google that's violated his right to express his viewpoint. Well, this is a truly interesting moment because tech does actually lack diversity, and Google prides itself in having an open office culture. But what happens when those two issues clash in the way that they have at Google? Well, joining us now with her perspective is Colleen Ammerman. She's director of Harvard Business School's Gender Initiative, and she's with us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Hi, Meghna.
Hi. Well, first of all, I should say that, again, I should reiterate that James Damore had written what was initially an internal memo for Google, and then over the weekend it got leaked. So it wasn't intended to be for the outside public, but we've all seen it now, and we'll put a link up to it at radioboston.org. What was your first response when you read his memo?
Well, my first response was, frankly, it's not that surprising.
Why?
Well, you know, I think for one thing, I think that these kinds of arguments and ideas have been circulating for a long time, right? So they're not new. I think the other reason it's not surprising is that, you know, these beliefs are pretty prevalent. So I think we are seeing the fact that there's maybe a kind of social stigma to holding these beliefs, but they're out there. People do think them. There's actually Pew has done some research on the extent to which people do believe there are these kinds of innate gender differences, mm-hmm. I don't know the stats offhand, but a lot of people do believe in these kinds of innate gender differences. And in fact, I think what's really key is that the more so that people have those beliefs, the more likely they are to hold traditional beliefs about gender roles and norms,
right,
and sort of what women and men should and shouldn't do.
So there are two parts to what Damore wrote. There's this sort of gender diversity in tech and Google, and at Google specifically, issue. And then there's also the part about viewpoint diversity. And we'll get to that in a second. But I just to stick with the gender part, I mean, what kind of, I'll be honest, really rubbed me the wrong way when I read it is that he was using wishy-washy science and drawing inferences for about women in general from supposed averages, mm-hmm. and therefore saying that it doesn't actually, he was like, we should actually apply cost-benefit analysis to all this, and it doesn't benefit Google to try and increase gender diversity in its workforce if women innately aren't that interested in tech.
Right, and so I think that's problematic on a couple of levels. So one is that the science behind the notion of innate characterological, biologically determined sex differences just isn't there. And I think you've seen a number of people kind of come out and say this, both, former Googlers. Adam Grant actually had a nice post on LinkedIn this morning kind of summarizing that research. So I think number one, it's just not true, right? I think the important thing to remember again is that, those beliefs may not be true, but they can seem true, right? So, I think one important thing to realize is that the kinds of bias that we're dealing with today, which are, as I think we all know, often implicit or unconscious, our founding faculty chair at the Gender Initiative, Robin Ely, has termed second-generation bias. These are subtle. They're not always explicit. And so they can look a lot like preferences, right? And so it might seem that what we're dealing with is women and men making different choices, but we're actually dealing with women and men facing very different kinds of contexts and reacting to those contexts.
Right. I mean, one of the things that really got me was when he says that he claims that men are more likely to be status-seeking and therefore seek out leadership positions, and women are less likely to do that. I mean, look, in the cases of certain individuals, that might be true, but it's such a wildly simplistic thing to say for one of the biggest gender gaps in tech in terms of leadership and executive level positions.
Right, which is not just true in tech, right?
It's true overall,
generally,
in the business world.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think, again, it's, the evidence is actually that's out there actually sort of supports the inverse relationship, right? So there's some research from sociologist Paula England, also some research from the 90s by Ruskin and Ruse, suggesting that what actually is more likely to happen is that as women move into professions, they lose status, right? So it's not so much women sort of happening to choose lower status professions or jobs or roles, but that what's associated with women when something becomes feminized, it loses status. I think the other thing that's really important, though, is, that I really want to highlight is that high status jobs in tech, but I think broadly, often come with a pretty high cost in terms of the kinds of hours and demands that are placed on people.
Well,
right?
And this is a point that Damore makes in his memo also. He says that women want more work-life balance, and so therefore they might not seek those jobs.
Exactly. And I think this is a great example of, this is not about preference. This is about the different kinds of conditions that men and women face. So long hour, high demand, high intensity jobs, research is very clear, are pretty unmanageable for everybody, right? And so, again, some of our own faculty, our chair, Robin Ely, also her colleague in the organizational behavior unit, Lakshmi Ramarajan, have done a field study that really shows that those kinds of demands do push people out of an organization, both men and women. What happens is that men and women respond differently to those pressures, right? And it's because of it's because of the gender norms and expectations that circulate in our culture, right? So men can actually be ideal workers, can put in a lot of hours at work, and sort of feel psychologically and socially rewarded as good parents because they are breadwinners, right? So there's a way in which the expectations for men come together in a way that allows them to pursue those kinds of careers with less psychological and social cost. For women, of course, it's diametrically opposed. The mandate to be an ideal worker, to be 100% devoted to your job, comes into direct conflict with the social mandate to be a good parent, be 100% devoted to your family. So women are really facing a kind of impossible choice.
Yeah.
And that's not really a reflection of their ambition or their aptitude or their competence.
Right. So what's really interesting to me about what happened to James Damore is, in a sense, he has once again prompted important conversations about diversity in the workplace and diversity in tech. I mean, he may have done so by putting forth wildly simplistic stereotypes that are easily refuted by other evidence. But nevertheless, the conversation is occurring. Google ended up firing him, saying that he was promulgating biases that were in opposition to the company's core values. But that plays right into what Damore's other point was that he believes there's a sore lack of viewpoint diversity at Google. I think you may have a point there. I mean, did Google handle this in the right way?
Well, so I don't work at Google. I don't run Google. So I don't want to sort of presume to
say. You are at Harvard Business School. Well, so.
True. But, you know, I work in higher ed, so I'm not running the company. But, you know, it is actually a tough question, and I think it's worth talking about. I in some ways think there's a little bit of a category confusion when we're in this conversation that we're having about the reaction from Google. You know, so, I mean, in terms of the company, you know, if I were running the company or in the company, one thing that would really concern me is if this, you know, is if this person is a manager, right? Because, you know, clearly he holds these beliefs and, you know, is willing to publicly circulate them within the company. And whether he realizes it or not, he probably is acting on them, right? So that's a concern in terms of you don't want managers in place who might be systematically disadvantaging people.
Well, and I think part of the issue at Google was they have if I remember correctly, they have a system by which, you know, peers are evaluating each other.
Right, right. Yeah. So it can have a real impact. And I think, of course, you know, as a lot of people have pointed out, you know, just circulating the memo itself has an effect on women in the company. And really is, I think, pretty destructive. You know, that said, though, I actually do think it's important to acknowledge that the memo, it is allowing us to have a conversation that we need to have. And I think, you know, he's right that these issues really aren't discussable. And that is a problem, right? So, you know, again, going back to what I said earlier, these beliefs are held by people, and whether or not people realize them, even if they realize maybe they're not socially acceptable, they are acting on them, even if it's unconscious. And we don't really have a forum to talk about that. And in fact, you know, that means we don't have a forum to say, hey, actually, the research doesn't bear out that there are gender differences. The research doesn't bear out that women aren't as good at negotiating. What the research bears out in the case of negotiation is that when the context is one where parameters are clear and the participants have equal access to information about the terms of the negotiation, we don't see gender differences, yeah. Right? Because we're not relying on stereotypes. So I actually do think it's important for us to be having this conversation and to make this something that is a discussable part of how we work.
So practically speaking then, mm-hmm. in the workplace, how do you do that? How do you have those conversations?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, one of the things that led to this moment is that Google, you know, has all these employee chat boards or rooms mm-hmm. or whatever, or a system by which they say they want to encourage open conversation, and it led to this.
Right. And that is, I mean, that is challenging. You know, it's challenging for companies and for leaders. I mean, I think, you know, just using the example of Harvard Business School, you know, there's been, you know, some coverage in the media of sort of how we as an institution have tackled diversity and inclusion. And I can absolutely say that the fact that our senior leadership and our dean really made it something that was discussable and acknowledged made a big difference. So I think a leadership commitment to that and to saying that it's important is key. Unconscious bias is a great example. You know, that especially in tech right now is kind of, you know, the sort of, you know, hot way, you know, one of the key ways to approach diversity. And there's all kinds of trainings out there.
But I mean, Damore's saying that there's an unconscious bias against conservatives in tech, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
That's basically what he said.
Well, and I think, you know, and I think what I would say about unconscious bias trainings is you can, you know, have as many as you want. They can be really great. People can really understand the science and the concept and maybe even fully buy into it and believe it and get it. But if you're not actually engaging in a conversation about implicit bias in your processes as they're happening, you're not really going to make change, right? Because unconscious bias is unconscious. So even once you go to the training, you're still doing it, right? So there needs to be space when you're thinking about evaluating people or mentoring people to raise those questions and sort of do some self-reflection and interrogation, you know, an interrogation among your colleagues. So really making it safe to discuss and saying it's a priority for us to have an ongoing conversation about it, not a kind of one and done, we've had a training, these are the norms, and the conversation's over,
right.
Sort of approach.
Right. So, you know, is this reverberating? I mean, there's obviously been a lot of in reaction to the memo and mm-hmm. Google's actions from all corners in the past couple of days. But do you think this has the possibility to reverberate for quite some time in tech because of the conversations it's triggered?
Hmm. I do. I hope so. I mean, you know, I think just even more broadly, it seems like we are having a pretty vibrant conversation, you know, about diversity and inclusion and different kinds of axes of inequality in organizations. I think for a lot of reasons, it seems to be kind of focused on tech right now. You know, we, of course, have had the recent stories about actually quite explicit sexual harassment and intimidation in Silicon Valley. You know, I think that for whatever reason, that seems to be the locus. But I think, the more that these stories come out, as disheartening as they can be, I think it does open up a space for conversation. And I, you know, certainly hope that it's something that persists.
Well, Colleen Ammerman is director of Harvard Business School's Gender Initiative. Colleen, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And before we wrap up, we just want to add this note that this hour, President Donald Trump has issued a stark warning to North Korea. Speaking at a meeting he's holding on the opioid crisis in Bedminster, New Jersey, the president said, quote, "North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with the fire and fury like and frankly power the likes of which this world has never seen." Well, stay tuned to WBUR's All Things Considered for more on that and the day's other news. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.